Rich, 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. Russian President Vladimir Putin has issued an apology after the crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines jet in Kazakhstan earlier this week, which killed 38 people. ABC's Inez de la Quatera is at the foreign desk.
The Kremlin press service now saying Russian President Vladimir Putin has apologized to the president of Azerbaijan for the fact that the tragic incident occurred in Russian airspace, but Putin stopping short of explicitly saying Russia was responsible for the crash.
The statement mentions that Russian air defense was active against Ukrainian drones in Russian airspace at the time when the plane was headed for its intended destination of Grozny in Russia. A new twist in the TikTok case. Lawyers for President-elect Donald Trump are now asking the Supreme Court to hold off on the case that would decide the app's future. They say they want more time to negotiate a deal to help the app avoid a ban in the U.S. Tornado watches are now in effect for parts of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. This is ABC News. Disturbing body camera video shows corrections officers in upstate New York brutally beating a handcuffed inmate for 15 minutes, eventually killing the man.
A preliminary autopsy ruling Brooks' death a homicide caused by asphyxia due to neck compression. New York Governor Kathy Hochul ordering the termination of 14 prison staffers, including bystanders. Brooks was serving a 12-year prison sentence for stabbing his girlfriend in 2017. An attorney for his family telling ABC News in part, Mr. Brooks was fatally, violently beaten by a group of officers whose job was to keep him safe. He deserved to live.
ABC's Morgan Norwood. One lucky Mega Millions winner. California's lottery says one person in that state bought a ticket that could bring home the $1.2 billion jackpot. The cash payout is just under $550 million. Plus, officials say they've raised just under $90 million for public schools over the course of the lottery. I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
When severe weather hits and the power goes out, do you have a plan? For reliable power and peace of mind, propane can do that. It only takes about 10 seconds for a propane-powered generator to restore power to your home. So no matter what Mother Nature has in store, you know you're prepared. Learn more at WIPGA.org. This message is sponsored by your local propane provider and the Wisconsin Propane Education and Research Council.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
The Dom Salvia Show.
How about this one? Harvey K., a Delano Democrat.
The problem with that is that that was his mother's family name. You might not realize that he had a father, too.
Come on, man.
Subscribe to my arguments and you can call a Dom Democrat.
All right, I'll take a Dom Democrat. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a big favorite here on this show.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. As we head into the new year, both shoppers and businesses are bracing for potential tariffs. Judith Ruiz Branch talks with a Wisconsin small business owner who says there couldn't be a worse time.
Eau Claire Outdoors is a shop that sells gear for camping and backwoods experiences. Owner Kate Felton says she carries products manufactured both in the U.S. and elsewhere.
The Trump tariffs really couldn't come at a worse time for small businesses. Certainly, there's no good time for this to come, but this moment in particular is just a very dangerous moment for prices to increase on small businesses.
Eau Claire small businesses saw record low sales this past year, she adds, including the lowest turnout for Small Business Saturday in over a decade. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to impose a new slate of tariffs as soon as he enters office in January. Tariffs, or taxes on imports, are paid by businesses purchasing goods from other countries. Economists say tariffs are typically passed on to consumers of anything the U.S. imports, from electronics and home goods to gas. Economics Department Chair Thomas Kemp at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire says he suspects a significant number of businesses in the state would feel the effects.
Let's say a small Wisconsin business is dependent upon a Chinese supplier for, say, machinery and equipment, that's going to impact them significantly. Or if they're a retailer that sells primarily goods and services made in China, they're going to be impacted by this.
In 2022, Wisconsin imports totaled $41 billion, the highest level recorded in state history, according to Wisconsin Economic Development. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Northern Wisconsin weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow. It'll be breezy out of the west, highs near 36. For tonight, some fog, clouds 25. For Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 38. Partly sunny, 37 for Monday. Clouds and 28 Tuesday.
Right now, it's 37.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, what does former FBI and CIA Director William Webster have to say about Cash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard? Also, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, on the rise of homelessness and political exhaustion. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review, and my name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, talking about all things government and rule of law and justice related. Thank you so much for spending some of your weekend time with me and my producer, Max. Together, we're taking your phone calls, as always, at 855-752-4842. 855-752-4842. You can also drop a question or an inquiry into the Civic Media box, and we will take a look at that and be responsive to you as a part of our continuing commitment, committed to our mission, which is to be a friend, an amicus, an entity that provides information that's helpful to understanding issues of our world. And indeed, that is precisely what animates this, the second hour of our broadcast, the last one of 2024. We're continuing, of course, well into 2025 and beyond as we talk about issues that are important to all of us. And that includes the issue of homelessness. That, yes, indeed, it is a housing issue. It is a social issue. It's a cultural issue. It's a government issue, but it's also a rule of law issue. We know from this report issued by the Department of Housing and Urban Development just this past week, the number of people experiencing homelessness in America, 770,000 people or more, an increase of 18% over last year. Biggest groups, steep increases among children, people with families. People in shelters rose by about a quarter. Unsheltered homeless people rose about 7%. Over the previous years, rise in homelessness among older adults continued as well. A 6% growth among those 65 or older. Once again, only veterans saw a modest decline in homelessness. The number of homeless veterans fell by 8% this past year. That is certainly good news, not completely addressing the problem. As long as there is one homeless person in America not being provided in some way, shape, or form with the mechanisms, the capacities to have a home in America, one of the basic tenets of the American dream, having a home, having a residence, a place to call your own. Now, why is this a rule of law issue? Well, it's a rule of law issue because, as we know well, the United States Supreme Court, as have other courts, weighed in on this very issue. What is it that municipalities and other cities and villages and towns, what can they do to address this issue? Of course, one of the things that we have seen is they've passed ordinances around the country that prohibit people who are inhabiting parks and other public places from doing just that. And the question in a case called Grants Pass versus Johnson, you may recall this. We talked a lot about this past term of the Supreme Court. In that case, the United States Supreme Court, by a divided court once again, 6-3, addressed the issue of homelessness in America. They plainly acknowledge that there is a challenge here, a huge challenge, but they found that, in fact, it is not a violation of the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. That Eighth Amendment, as you know, prohibits cruel and unusual punishment in all areas. We You talked already about it in the context of the death penalty. Here again, petitioners who are homeless people from the state of Oregon and in particular the city of Grants Pass maintain that it's cruel and unusual treatment by their municipality to enforce these ordinances that prevent them from living in these public spaces. And the Supreme Court, again, divided court. A fairly clearly divided court. This is not a close question for the 6-3, one side and the other, taking very different views of this, saying that, in fact, it's not a violation of the Constitution for municipalities to enforce these ordinances, to getting people to move off of those principal areas where the public convenes, including parks and other public areas. That is not without its controversy. But it also establishes plainly inside this rule of law analysis that we always do here on the broadcast, a basis for understanding what we do next. Because once again, this is one of the things certainly that municipalities now, by virtue of what the Supreme Court has said, they can do this. Indeed, Gavin Newsom in the state of California announced not long after Grants Pass, that decision was decided, that he would move forward with municipalities and villages and towns in enforcing these ordinances, even while, and this is the point, even while inside the rule of law and outside of courts, in the legislatures, in the town councils, in the other mechanisms for representative government in America, including California, including right here in Wisconsin. Mechanisms for addressing the problem of homelessness continued. Nothing about the Supreme Court case says that municipalities cannot do remedial things, supportive things, encouraging constructive things to address what plainly, according to the Housing and Urban Development Department, continues to be a significant problem and challenge for our nation. It will continue to be that plainly as 2024 moves into 2025. This administration, again, through the Department of Housing and Urban Development, reporting on this, but also doing many things in terms of policies to address the issue. With a change in administration, this, like so many other things that we discuss here on our broadcast, also accomplishes a change in policy. Plainly, homelessness not a major feature of the past campaign, but the Department of Housing and Urban Development has a lot to do with our cities, our municipalities, the ways that they look, the ways that they function, the ways that people live in the 21st century in our cities. That's the whole focus on housing and urban development, where the department gets its name. Huge amounts of money's there. And the question is, how does an administration, how does a Biden administration, how does the incoming Trump administration use those monies allocated in the budget through the Congress to the president through this Department of Housing and Development? How does it do things to remedy the challenges, including homelessness, of our urban locations? All of that remaining to be seen in 2025 as a new administration takes place, as it takes its offices in Washington, D.C., and in other offices, HUD offices around the nation, including right here in the state of Wisconsin, represented them on a fairly regular basis when I was an assistant U.S. attorney here in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. They are a part of our local practice. They're a part of our local areas. And it is the local people, the local officials, those civil servants who do their job so faithfully, who are responsible for ensuring that those monies are properly spent, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the nation. Department of Housing and Development, no small thing, no small feature of our federal government as we continue to wrestle with the issue of homelessness in America. Promised at the start of our broadcast that we would also talk about some other things related to the United States Supreme Court. And that is some news having to do with both TikTok and, yes, indeed, ethics and Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito once again back in the news this past week. All of that related to our continuing focus on the United States Supreme Court. Let's talk first about TikTok in particular. You may recall well, the Congress, not too long ago, earlier this year, passed a major ban. Bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans alike, in response to years of concern, lots of testimony before Senate and House committees, that TikTok's Chinese parent company poses a national security threat to the United States of America because, as the Biden administration maintains and others have testified to Congress in their own presentations, the TikTok entity, as it is presently owned and operated, can both collect data on users and manipulate that content that the users may see. Not only collecting data, but also manipulating content on TikTok. That was the concern that prompted the United States Congress to pass legislation that bans TikTok come January 19th. Yes, that's right. It's a day before Donald Trump's inauguration. By January 19th, TikTok either goes out of business in the United States of America, banned by virtue of this federal legislation, or alternatively, it can divest. It can divest of any connection to the Chinese parent company, based once again upon this concern by the administration, but also plainly by a bipartisan group of leaders in the United States Congress. That's the House, that's the Senate, that there are national security concerns, a lot of them unrealized, not a whole lot of evidence yet, direct evidence of this happening, but an awful lot of belief that TikTok both collects data on users and also can manipulate that data that the users may see. And that prompted, once again, that's the legislative predicate. That's the rule of law premise upon which the Congress then passes legislation. Joe Biden signed that legislation, not without controversy. And that is the law now, that by January 19th, one of two things happen. Either TikTok goes out of business in the United States of America or announces that there is a sale of at least its United States, its American component to a non-Chinese entity. That's all the history that leads up to this. Well, we know as well that TikTok, getting some unfavorable rulings out of the lower courts, trying desperately to stop this from happening, to put it on hold, to find that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights, arguably your First Amendment rights, gone into federal court unsuccessfully to this point, seeking to have the lower courts say, nope, the Congress cannot do this. The Congress does not have the constitutional prerogative, the discretion to limit what TikTok, a voice of people in America and around the world, can do. A First Amendment violation, right to speech, right to advocacy, arguing this is a violation of the Constitution unsuccessfully. And the lower court saying that, no, the national security interests outweigh those interests established under the First Amendment. Not at all an easy thing to debate, because it's highly controversial and reasonable people can differ on this particular notion. Nonetheless, TikTok not being successful up to this point and petitioning not only for a reversal of what the Congress has done, but also to stave it off, to move it down the road, give them more time. That also has been denied. And therefore, TikTok, as we reported here on Amicus, a law review, TikTok runs to the Supreme Court and says, stop this from happening. And we need you to act very promptly. They filed an emergency application. And indeed, as we have reported previously, the Supreme Court's going to have a hearing, oral argument on all of this. What's going on with TikTok on January 10th? Just a few days from now, not too long, early in the new year, among the first cases it's going to hear oral argument on in 2025 on all of these TikTok-related appeals, including whether or not the deadline date of just 9 days later remains in place or not. Now, what happened? That's all, again, predicate for what happened just this past week, and that is that the president-elect, Donald Trump, is now weighing in on this. We know that the Biden administration has previously filed its brief, arguing once again that national security concerns compel that the court not only support what the Congress has done, that the president signed this legislation, it's good, it's constitutional. The Biden administration taking the position that TikTok needs to go away, at least in America, or divest itself. Donald Trump this past week weighing in on that with an amicus brief of his own. When Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about exactly what Donald Trump is saying to the Supreme Court in this highly topical issue now pending in our highest court as our broadcast.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Cindy from Appleton.
Time Magazine has made the convicted felon the man of the year this year. Shame on them.
Time Magazine base their person of the year on impact and, like, newsmaking. The CEO assassination is pretty much the only news cycle that isn't entirely focused on Donald Trump, and yet it still relates to him because he has no health care policy.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
My name is Jim Santel, your host here on Amicus, a law review, talking about these rule of law issues, these justice issues, these court and government issues of just this past week. Donald Trump filing an amicus brief just this past week. A friend of the court, that's his position in his filing to the United States Supreme Court. Many other amicus briefs also being filed by non-parties, asking the court to do various things, expressing their interest, their various concerns about this issue related to TikTok and its future viability here in the United States of America, set to sunset, set to go away on January 19th, the day before Donald Trump takes the oath of office as the next president of the United States of America. Donald Trump, the president-elect, urged the United States Supreme Court just this past week in his filing, again, through his lawyers, to pause this controversial ban on TikTok set to take effect again in just a few days. He told the justices in this legal filing late this past week that this delay that he is seeking would allow his administration to pursue a negotiated resolution. He said, I'm going to come into this. I'm going to resolve this in some way. His request is not premised upon a particular position statement, but rather requesting that the Supreme Court hold off on doing anything here and postpone the deadlines here until he can become involved, and plainly cannot become involved until at least one day after the deadline date goes into effect. His request for a delay in implementing the ban puts him at odds, plainly, with the Biden administration, which has defended the law very vigorously in its own brief, saying once again that there would be grave national security concerns about TikTok's continued operation in the United States of America. We've got the position of the present administration, Joe Biden, at odds, or at least seemingly at odds, with what the incoming president has articulated. It's one of the most significant or First Amendment cases, again, pending before the Supreme Court. It'd be interesting to see what they do, not only in the weeks just ahead with respect to this looming deadline, but also long term about whether or not the First Amendment prohibits the Congress from doing what it did. They have to weigh whether the ban that the legislature imposed violates the First Amendment. And the court has already scheduled, as I indicated, this oral argument for January 10th. The court was flooded, quite literally, with other briefs, along with the president-elect's brief on Friday from various groups. They're all seeking to have some say, some involvement in this. This is a friend of the court brief. That's the amicus, or sometimes called the amicus brief approach, which also gives our name to our broadcast. But given the fact that the ban is expected to take place on the 19th, all of this takes increased urgency. Now, once again, Donald Trump in his brief didn't take a formal position on the underlying First Amendment questions that are proposed and by the present litigation and opposed by TikTok, but instead just asked the court to delay that January 19th effective date, basically sort of accomplishing a legislative fix, if you will, for a while, so that he can come in and presumably resolve this issue. He said this: he wants the additional time to allow the incoming administration to pursue a negotiated resolution that could prevent a nationwide shutdown of TikTok, thus preserving the First Amendment rights of tens of millions of Americans while also addressing the government's national security concerns. All of that coming in his brief. His brief also went on to claim that he is operating with a, quote, powerful electoral mandate. That's how he described the recent election result, and that he is uniquely positioned to resolve this TikTok controversy. At one point in the brief, he described himself as one of the most powerful, prolific, and influential users of social media in history. Went on to say this. This is in his amicus brief to the Supreme Court. He said, the First Amendment implications of the federal government's effective shuttering of a social media platform used by 170 million Americans are sweeping and troubling. There are valid concerns, he wrote, that the act may set a dangerous global precedent by exercising the extraordinary power, he calls it, to shut down an entire social media platform based in large part on concerns about disfavored speech on that platform. Now, in response to that, the Biden administration took exception to it and once again, in its own brief, wrote about the grave consequences if this legislation does not go into effect. All of this heightening the stakes in this matter. Will TikTok remain a viable entity, a legal entity, or did it already run afoul, if you will, of the national security concerns that animate the legislation? What is the change in government that's going to happen not before January 19th, but on January 20th, one day before the ban takes place? How does that impact what the Supreme Court's going to be entertaining on January 10th when it entertains oral argument about all of this, including a stay, which is what the president-elect is seeking? And frankly, TikTok's position, once again, that all of this should be dismissed, all of this should be overturned. The Congress had no capacity, TikTok maintains, to do this in the first place. So Supreme Court, put an end to this. Exalt the First Amendment and permit us to continue operating. Others maintaining plainly in the government that national security interests outweigh the extraordinary and considerable benefits of a First Amendment that's alive and well. That's what the Supreme Court's going to be arguing on the 10th day of the new year. Of course, here on Amicus, we'll be reporting on exactly what that is all about and how our Supreme Court justices seem to be lining up in that particular area. Supreme Court continues to be in our news in other ways, and this also related to the interplay between the United States Congress and indeed the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Supreme Court itself. We know well that there has been sparring not only between the United States Supreme Court, some members in particular, Sam Alito, one of the associate justices, maintaining very strongly in public statements of recent years that the United States Congress can impose nothing on the United States Supreme Court in the nature of a rule of law type set of ethics codes, rules, principles, that itself raises constitutional issues that the Supreme Court can regulate itself if it chooses to do so, but that the United States Congress can't do that. And the Supreme Court, of course, has done something in response to that. You recall well, we reported on this a little over a year ago, that John Roberts assembled what is basically an aspirational set of standards and principles, according to which the Supreme Court should argue, not really an ethics code, but a statement of aspirational principles for when justices should recuse themselves, when they shouldn't, those kinds of things, when they should report on trips and other benefits gotten by them from people who may be practicing in front of them, appearing in front of them in cases in which they're deciding major issues, all of those things set forth in a standard set forth and signed by all the justices. But the problem, of course, no enforcement. Elena Kagan said that we've got to have enforcement of this. Other justices have likewise hinted some enforcement mechanism is appropriate. And yet we don't have that yet. A code of ethics does apply to all the lower court federal judges, the appeals courts that we talk a lot about here on this broadcast, the district courts, the trial courts out of which all these cases percolate from, all of them subject to a very clear and unmistakable set of principles that guide, again, recusals and other things. This past week, the Senate Judiciary Committee once again weighing in with a report, not only on this larger issue, but once again on Clarence Thomas. When we come back, we'll talk more about exactly what the Senate has said about that in this major report here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt and Air on Air.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. Russian President Vladimir Putin has issued an apology after the crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines jet in Kazakhstan earlier this week, which killed 38 people. ABC's Inez de la Quatera is at the foreign desk.
The Kremlin press service now saying Russian President Vladimir Putin has apologized to the president of Azerbaijan for the fact that the tragic incident occurred in Russian airspace, but Putin stopping short of explicitly saying Russia was responsible for the crash.
The statement mentions that Russian air defense was active against Ukrainian drones in Russian airspace at the time when the plane was headed for its intended destination of Grozny in Russia. A new twist in the TikTok case. Lawyers for President-elect Donald Trump are now asking the Supreme Court to hold off on the case that would decide the app's future. They say they want more time to negotiate a deal to help the app avoid a ban in the U.S. Tornado watches are now in effect for parts of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Badgers hockey in Milwaukee. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college hockey, it's the Wisconsin Badgers against Ferris State tonight at Five Serve Forum. It's part of the holiday face-off tournament going on this weekend. The Badgers hope to improve their record of 7-10-1. NFL, the Packers face the Vikings in Minnesota. 3:25 tomorrow, Vikings star wide receiver Justin Jefferson.
Just going against Green Bay, you know, everybody know we hate them and they hate us. The fans know just the whole rivalry in general is something to get juiced up about. So I definitely rank this one high.
Packers quarterback Jordan Love.
I mean, all the motivation is right there. It's division opponent. Obviously, they beat us first game. So we're going into their place. And, you know, we want to get some of that revenge that we're looking for. So we're trying to go down there and handle business in the NFC North, which we've dropped a couple games already this year. So we need to go get a win.
That's Jordan Love with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Northern Wisconsin weather. I'm Corey Hartman. For today, chance of rain and snow. It'll be breezy out of the west. Highs near 36. For tonight, some fog, clouds 25. For Sunday, mostly cloudy with a high near 38. Partly sunny, 37 for Monday. Clouds and 28 Tuesday.
Right now, it's 37.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A 2023 decision in an Arkansas redistricting case found individual voters did not have a private right of action to challenge the maps. The state of Louisiana tried the same tactic in its chaotic gerrymandering case, but was refused on June 24th. Be looking for another challenge in 2025. Defying precedent, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals held in a 2023 Arkansas racial gerrymandering case that individual voters do not have a private right of action under the VRA Section 2. It said only the U.S. Justice Department could bring such cases, despite individuals having filed 90% of previous challenges. Calling it radical, scholars expected it to be quickly overturned, but this January, the full Eighth Circuit refused to rehear the case. Seeing an opening, Louisiana asked the full Fifth Circuit to rehear its gerrymandering case on the same grounds, with 13 other Republican attorneys general urging a no private right of action decision. In a close vote Monday, the Fifth Circuit refused that rehearing. For now, the Eighth Circuit decision still only affects Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. But it's clear that private right of action is the new battleground and will almost certainly reach the U.S. Supreme Court. We've linked to more on the private right of action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
UW Systems spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. Three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Appleton-based comedian John Egan into the studio. Then Chicago comedians Bill Gorgo and Jim McHugh join the show to promote a New Year's Eve extravaganza in Port Washington. Let's light it up.
Weeknights from 6 till 8.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for these remaining segments of our weekend broadcast, the last one of 2024, continuing into 2025. Of course, as one of our major topics has always been, continues to be the United States Supreme Court, the lack of an ethics code that is enforceable, bemoaned by many of us, including members of the Supreme Court themselves, who've talked about mechanisms for ensuring that the Supreme Court's ever-dropping political and public ranking, if you will, the extent to which we rely upon and feel strong about the legitimacy of our Supreme Court continues to drop in America. That's not the only reason for doing it. The more important reason, of course, is to ensure that the integrity is a part of all of the decisions of the United States Supreme Court, that you don't have justices who are deciding cases of their friends in which they have political and economic and social and cultural interests of all kinds. This past week, the United States Senate, through the Judiciary Committee, in one of the last actions of the democratically controlled United States Senate, released a major report on the judiciary, many, many aspects of this, talking about judges and talking about the ways in which the judiciary has behaved or not behaved in this past year or so. 93 pages of a report. And reveals, in fact, some more things about what Clarence Thomas has and has not reported. It concluded a nearly two-year ethics investigation, again, by calling on the United States Supreme Court or the United States Congress to establish an enforceable code of conduct, and also identified some recurring problems with reporting by Clarence Thomas, who, of course, is an associate justice of the Supreme Court. The 93-page report reveals two more additional undisclosed reports that were taken by Justice Thomas in 2021, not so very long ago. Among those, apparently, were a private jet flight to the Adirondacks in July and a lavish jet and yacht trip to New York City in October of 2021, both of them funded by, once again, you've heard this name before, is billionaire Harlan Crowe. Harlan Crowe had at least one, if not more, pieces of litigation pending derivatively through his companies before the United States Supreme Court. These highlights of this report coming out of the Judiciary Committee just this past week, again, accompany more than two dozen other prior reportings by Clarence Thomas, in which he received luxury travel and gifts from wealthy benefactors like Crowe and like others, none of which were initially reported in annual financial disclosure forms. And that's the problem. That's the problem. This reporting continues to be problematic. In 2023, the court again did establish this set of guidelines, not enforceable, requiring that all the justices be responsible for reporting these kinds of things. But plainly, even in the wake of that, even in the wake of amending his previous reports, Clarence Thomas was not complete, did not do everything. And once again, we've got these reports of additional reports of his engaging in communications, but also trips, gifts given to him by Harlan Crowe in 2021. Things we didn't previously know about, now disclosed by virtue of this two-year investigation, now concluded by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Dick Durbin, the chair of that committee, saying the highest court in the land can't have the lowest ethical standards. And again, that a part of his continuing advocacy, not only for an ethics code, but also for all the justices to come clean and describe for the American public the sources of all of their income. All of this, of course, rebuked, if you will, by representatives of Clarence Thomas, also rebuked by other people on the Supreme Court, including other justices who have likewise been the subject of focus. Indeed, the report traces the practice of accepting these undisclosed gifts back long before Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito were a part of our national discussion about this. It says numerous trips back to the time of the late Justice Antonin Scalia's term on the court, he established the practice during his decades on the bench of taking reports, undisclosed gifts, undisclosed report trips during the course of his tenure. The late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and retired Justice Stephen Breyer, also a part of this report, also took subsidized trips, according to the report. But those justices disclosed them. on their annual financial forms, which is now required of all the justices. That's the difference. The investigation once again revealing, confirming that Clarence Thomas accepted gifts, travel from wealthy benefactors, including Harlan Crow, valued at more than $4.75 million since his confirmation way back in 1991. Much of it just begrudgingly disclosed, if at all. Interestingly, as this recusal issue goes forward, we know that justices can do this on the Supreme Court. Justice Neil Gorsuch recently cited this code of conduct that guides him, at least, when he recused himself for an environmental case. He had been under pressure to step aside due to some potential conflicts of interest. He finally said yes. The court's outcome on that case should not be tainted in any way by my involvement with a Colorado billionaire whom Gorsuch had previously represented before his appointment to the bench. And so justices can do this. They do it. And indeed, Justice Gorsuch, as have other justices, including Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, all advocating not only for an enforceable code of ethics, but they themselves following these recusal mandates. All of that coming out again from this report issued by the Senate Judiciary Committee just this past week, commenting more generally upon all things justice related. I commend your attention to, if not the entire 93-page report, nonetheless, some reporting on it, which is important. Once again, Clarence Thomas in the news as 2024 comes to an end because he failed to properly identify and report on his own additional gifts that we did not know about previously. We've spent a lot of time on our broadcast talking about things overseas, and that will continue to be the case in the new year and beyond as well. In South Korea, which we have reported on a lot and commented on a lot about the importance of what the residents, the citizens of South Korea have done in the wake of the attempt early this month by the president of that nation, Mr. Yoon, to impose martial law. It lasted about just a few hours and a day in early December. The residents, the citizens of South Korea rising up as they continue to do to this day and say, no, no, we're not going to take that. That is not a part of our mission. That's not a part of our contemplation of what a democratic republic here in Seoul should be and throughout South Korea. And so that has resulted, as we know, in the attempt to impeach President Yoon and his ill-fated martial law bid, setting off a huge amount of turmoil. Those proceedings continue to go forward. Yoon no longer in a position of responsibility. Well, just this past Friday, lawmakers voted to oust a second head of state, another one, the acting president, the second time this has happened in 2 weeks. And, of course, this prolongs this political vacuum that is gripping South Korea since President Yoon shocked the country with this military rule, placing the country under this military rule for the first time in decades. Lawmakers just this past week, again, not only reaffirmed the impeachment of Mr. Yoon on December 14th, but also impeached the acting president, Prime Minister Han Duk-soo. And the reason for that impeachment was because he, Soo, refused to appoint three judges to fill vacancies to something called the Constitutional Court there. That's the body, and that's the reason why this is all relevant, the body that's deciding whether to reinstate or formally remove the president himself, Mr. Yoon. At the heart of the matter, as you can well imagine, then, is how the court might rule on Yoon's impeachment. So six or more justices of this 9-member high court have to vote in favor of impeachment in their system to remove Yoon from office. And the court right now only has six justices. Three others retired early this year, according to reports. And the impeachment could be overturned with just one dissenting voice in Yoon's trial. That's why the statement, the reinstatement, the naming, the nomination, the placement of more justices on this court is an impediment, if it's not done, to moving forward on all of these impeachments. The failure of the president, the current president, the acting president, Yoon Suk-yeol, or rather President, Prime Minister Han Duk-soo, in failing to assign and appoint these additional justices, that's what prompted the Congress House there, the National Assembly, to move to impeach him now. So now we have two impeachments pending in Seoul, in South Korea. All of this adding, again, to the vacuum of power at a significant time with one of Washington's, our own nation's most important allies, country grappling not only with North Korea, the nuclear threats there, economic challenges at home. Not a good time for there to be this vacuum, but nonetheless caused, again, by President Yoon in initially doing this martial law imposition, and the people once again insisting upon a system of government that is responsive to them, that is legitimate, that has integrity. And even in this second impeachment of Prime Minister Han Duck-soo, now serving as the interim president, insisting that he act on the best behavior that he should act on pursuant to that, should be naming these additional justices so that the process can move forward. That's what the people of South Korea, through their elected representatives, are once again asking for. That's what the advocacy is all about. That's why they continue to take to the streets to this day, to advocate for a more fair and just and rule of law animated South Korea. We continue to look to them not only to see what happens in that ally of ours in Asia on the other side of the planet, but also as guidance for us about what the way we approach the things that our government does and does not do in present times and in the future. We'll talk about all of that as Amicus, a law review, continues to monitor things in the international arena. Promised at the outset that we would spend the last portions of our time here in this last broadcast of 2024 identifying some of the top rule of law events of 2024. We have talked about all of these. They're local. They're Wisconsin related. They are national. And yes, indeed, they're international. One of them, of course, is indeed this martial law and the consequences of it in South Korea. What are those that I would identify as the top 15 rule of law events of 2024? Let's begin some identification of those right now. At the top of the list, necessarily, once again, our United States Supreme Court on July 1 issuing this major opinion, changing the Constitution that establishes for the first time in our history, as we have so often said, that a sitting president can, in fact, be immune from prosecution for crimes committed in office. That is colossal. That is catastrophic. Absolute immunity for engagements with the U.S. Department of Justice that's responsible for the rule of law. We will see how that plays out in the new administration and administrations to come, and whether or not that opinion has lasting viability in an America that, at least up to now, has, like the South Koreans, insisted on more. Insisted that our public officials, including the president, not be above the law. That's a decision that placed him above the law in many ways. Second major rule of law event of 2024, the Trump conviction. Undeniably, in that Manhattan court, 34 counts. Donald Trump to this day, even as he looks forward to his own swearing in on the 20th of January, he remains a convicted felon for 34 counts of violating New York law. And that returned again by a jury of his peers unanimously, beyond a reasonable doubt, finding that he violated New York law when it comes to making false statements in records and false representations in those records about the uses of monies to pay off Stormy Daniels in advance of the 2016 election. You know all about that. That conviction, again, going to be the subject of some more attention between now and the 20th of January. We're waiting for Juan Merchan to determine whether or not he will sentence Donald Trump for those counts of conviction or do something else, including either dismissing that case or holding off for 4 or 5 years before doing so. A major rule of law event of 2024. We go back to the Supreme Court for number three, and that is the SCOTUS, the Supreme Court decision in that Chevron deference case. It's Loper Bright Enterprises. We talked a lot about it. It's the case in which, for the first time in 40 years, the Supreme Court drop-kicked this thing that keeps our agencies representing us and keeps them honest and doing work on behalf of the American population as civil servants, finding that the deference, the decisions by federal courts that should rely upon the expertise of those honest and decent civil servants should be given accord, no longer according to the Supreme Court, number three on our list of rule of law events. When we come back, the remaining 12 rule of law events of 2024 here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Rudolph is a holiday classic, and there's a Wisconsin connection. Maury Laws composed music for the animated show in 1964. He continued arranging hundreds of songs from his Appleton home after leaving New York 20 years later. During that time, Laws created one quirky pop song. Do you know what it is? The answer coming up.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is sort of where a lot of people's core Christmas memories come from.
Emily Locke with the Oshkosh Museum on holiday traditions around Rudolph. Laws worked for the TV production company behind the show and also wrote music for Frosty the Snowman. And about the silly song he composed? Yes, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. Laws died in 2019 at the age of 95, but his music lives on as a wonderful slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Counting down now, the top 15 rule of law events on my list. Maybe they're on your list too. Maybe there are more. There certainly are more that are out there that we have talked about on this broadcast throughout these past 2.5 years. One, presidential immunity by the Supreme Court. Two, the Trump conviction. The first time in the history of America that a former president has been found guilty of crimes in a state court, in any court. Number three, that Chevron deference case, finding again by the Supreme Court that federal agencies, federal courts no longer have to defer to the expertise, the people who know what they're talking about when it comes to deciding cases before them. Those are huge cases pending before and now resolved by the Supreme Court. We've got more on our top 15 rule of law events list. Number four, of course, the continuing issue comes out of the decision of a couple of years ago in that Dobbs decision. The continuing work that we've reported on throughout this past year on abortion rights, privacy rights, the consequences of that decision overturning Roe versus Wade in our legislatures, in our referendums, in our courts around the country, causing this patchwork of decisions and policies and practices when it comes to abortion, plainly not yet resolved in America in any way. And indeed, the Supreme Court now entertaining even more cases related to this fundamental right that existed for nearly 50 years before Sam Alito and a majority of the Supreme Court found that that privacy right no longer exists in the Constitution, a major animating rule of law event in 2024. We've already talked about number five, the TikTok controversy. The Congress deciding that this entity can no longer exist, it is going to overlap 2024 into 2025, as we reported earlier. As the Supreme Court takes up this decision about what happens to TikTok, our incoming president taking a position contrary to our present president of what should happen there. We've already talked also about number six on my list. It's South Korea. The decision by South Korean citizens to rise up and say that they will not tolerate the imposition of this kind of military law in their nation and impeaching not one, but two of their leaders for failing to do the things that are in the best interests of their nation. South Korea, number six on the list. Number seven, elections. One of them positive, one of them not positive. One of them in Mexico, a nation just to the south, the first woman president ever, Claudia Sheinbaum, 65th president of the nation, took office in October of this past year. She was previously the mayor of Mexico, a major milestone that the United States of America has not yet crossed. The Americans have not yet elected a female, a woman. The Mexicans have. Claudia Sheinbaum, first woman president of Mexico. In Venezuela, again to the south, this is A and B of number seven, by the way. Nicolas Maduro in a contested election with Edmundo Gonzalez. Gonzalez almost certainly winning the presidency in Venezuela by a wide margin, according to all reporting. Nonetheless, Maduro accomplishing something that should not happen in the rule of law nations. He is still in office. Gonzalez has fled to Spain. And again, rule of law not active in Venezuela as Maduro basically holds on to power, getting his Supreme Court to certify an election that he did not win. Number 7A and 7B. Number 8, Again, Gisèle Pelicot. We've talked a lot about her in recent times. This is from France. This is the case in which this icon, this major figure, brought to justice the 50 men who brutally, viciously raped, sexually assaulted her, including her own husband, over a period of a decade, bringing them to justice over a three-month trial, vindicating the rights that she had, and announcing once again the power of victims to get justice. Imperfect, incomplete for her and her family. Tragedy, undeniably. Gisèle Pelicot, a hero on the planet. Number nine, Julian Assange. Whether he is a hero or not is another question, but the United States negotiating a plea agreement with him in June. He is now in Australia, no longer in custody. He pled guilty in the federal court to one count of conspiracy to disclose classified national security defense documents. He's the WikiLeaks guy, you may recall. He pled guilty, brought that long-standing odyssey when he is in the custody variously in countries around the world, never back here in the United States, but brought to justice ultimately by virtue of a plea agreement that has him accomplishing a time-served result. He's now back in Australia, and that episode now over in America. 10, 11, and 12 are the charges of various people. You know them well. Recently, Luigi Mangione for the brutal, vicious murder on the streets of Manhattan of the United Healthcare CEO. That continuing to be a subject of a huge amount of focus in America. We'll talk more about that in the future. Sean Diddy Combs, we've talked about him only briefly. Federal sex trafficking allegations against him, likely going to trial sometime in the coming year, changing not only the course of his career, plainly, but also once again underscoring the importance of the rule of law when it comes to basic human rights to be free from sex trafficking, the victims of him, of his, coming forward more and more. And Brian Koberger, a name you may not recognize, he is the alleged murderer in the November of 2023, University of Idaho, horrific murder. Federal and state charges there as well. Luigi Mangione also federal and state charges. Brian Koberger, as a result of a lot of pretrial activities of recent times, in the news a lot. That case probably also, at least the state case, going to trial in 2025. The alleged murder, we, as to all three of these, Koberger and Mangione and Combs, we recognize, we embrace the notion that they are not guilty. They are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law by competent evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. All three of them charged in major cases of just this past year. And then we have things right here in the state of Wisconsin. We've got this continuing issue with related to Act 10, 2011, changing the ways in which a variety of teachers and nurses and prison officials and state employees have actions as members of unions and can assemble. That Act 10 basically stripping of them of their rights. Many, many cases in the state of Wisconsin challenging that. Right now, recently, back in the courts, Judge Jacob Frost recently finding that portions of that Act 10 law from way back in 2011 violate the Equal Protection Clause because there are two categories of people identified in that. And a major issue in the state of Wisconsin right here at home for those of us who are residents concerned about not only the actions of our Supreme Court, but the lower courts here. Judge Jacob Frost in the Dane County Circuit Court finding just recently that Act 10, at least in part, is unconstitutional. Plainly not the last story there. And finally, dramatically, horrifically, the Madison shooting at the Abundant Life Christian School. Two dead, a teacher and a young student as well. Six hurt in addition to that. And, of course, the assailant, the shooter herself, apparently committing suicide there. Again, all of those kinds of things happening right here in the state of Wisconsin, in the United States of America, in our world, our continuing commission here on Amicus Law Review to bring you those major stories in the rule of law and justice and government. Stay with us for all our future broadcasts. Have a good weekend, everybody. Have a good and peaceful new year.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Dom Selvia.
Next time, what does former FBI and CIA Director William Webster have to say about Cash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard? Also, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, on the rise of homelessness and political exhaustion. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Todd Albaugh Show.
UW System spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. 3 times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubosky. Russian President Vladimir Putin apologized to Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev after that deadly crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines jet this past week in Kazakhstan. Some have speculated Russian anti-aircraft systems may have accidentally shot the plane down. Putin did not claim responsibility for that specifically, but did apologize for it happening in Russian airspace. Parts of the West Coast are bracing for severe weather. Meteorologist Greg Dutra from Chicago ABC station WLS.
The hits keep on coming, especially for the West Coast, where yet again the atmospheric river developing and determining that they're going to get another couple rounds of rain over the next few days. 3 total rounds of rain. Northern California, Southern Oregon seeing up to 10 inches of rain. High surf warnings from San Francisco to LA and feet of snow in the Rockies. That's prompting a rare 4 out of 5 avalanche danger.
Meanwhile, in the South, parts of Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi are under tornado watches. This is ABC News.